This is the first talk in a series of three. So there's going to be a talk on the first Saturday of each month. So the next one is on the 3rd of November, then the 1st of December. And there is a bit of a theme for all three talks, which I hope will become clear as we go through. And in the Saturdays in between, the Buddhism class will continue. So if you want to learn more about Buddhism and also do some meditation together or learn meditation if you don't know it already, then carry on coming along on Saturday mornings. And from now on, the Saturday morning class as a whole will start at 10:15 from next week onwards. So you can come for a whole morning, meditation in the first half, Buddhism in the second half. If you don't want to be coming every Saturday, then that talk on the first Saturday of the month will always be there at 11:30. So on that first Saturday, you don't need to come for the 10:15, you can come at 11:30. The talks are free, but there is a charge for the whole morning class, which is £10 or £5 concessions. So that's what's happening. And what this talk is about is on the significance in Buddhism of what you might call neediness or craving in Buddhism and in life. And the title is Needing Nothing. And I want to explore that whole idea from the Buddhist tradition of needing nothing, what craving is, what need means, and so on. So imagine needing nothing. Maybe you don't have to imagine it, maybe you don't need anything, but you may have to imagine it. Imagine needing nothing. And there's a story of an ancient Chinese sage from 3,000 years ago who was very well known, a venerable and popular sage. And apparently every day he could be found sitting by the river. Very common thing to do in Britain as well, because he had a fishing rod. And there he was fishing in the river. And his disciples and his admirers would come up to him and say, how could you do this? How could you, a great sage, be inflicting this cruelty on the poor fish of them getting caught with a barbed hook through their mouth and all this horrible sort of thing like this? So he pulled the line out of the water and there was no hook and there was no bait. He was just sitting there fishing. And I don't know if there's any truth in this story, but I did have a friend when I lived in Milton Keynes, Clive. Really nice guy. He became vegetarian, but he was absolutely addicted to fishing. He loved going fishing. So after he became vegetarian, this is true, what he used to do was to sit by the River Ouse or in one of the fishing pools there, and he just tied a crust of bread to the end of his line, but with no hook. And he'd sit there, and every time he got a bite from a fish, he'd write, yeah, I caught it. No. And he'd write it down as having been caught. And then he'd put some more bread on and he'd throw it in again. And in fact, he caught far more fish than any of the other anglers along the River Ouse. Although sometimes I thought maybe it was the same fish coming back again each time who'd learnt. So in a way, the Chinese sage and my friend Clive in Milton Keynes, they didn't actually have any need to catch the fish. There's something else going on there, isn't it, where you enjoy that sense of, maybe that sense of getting to know the creatures that you're involved with, but also just sitting quietly. What a lovely thing to do. You can see why a lot of people like to do it in this country, is sit quietly by a riverbank, watch the herons going by, the birds singing, maybe the weather changing, the river passing by. It's a very, very meditative thing to do. It's a little bit different for the fish, at least the fish who are not having to confront the very rare fisherman who doesn't put a hook on the end of the line. But the fish itself, if you think about it, is responding to that basic animal need for food. And it detects an attractive little bit of bait wiggling about in the water, and it grabs it. And then in turn, the fish finds itself hauled out of the water. And this seems a bit of a metaphor for what life is sometimes about. You know, we grab things, and then we find there's a barb on the end of what we grab, and we're hauled into something that we're not planning at all. And this brings us on to Buddhism, because there's a very simple pattern in Buddhist teaching. If you have that needy approach, that craving approach, then that leads to grabbing things. But grabbing things leads to things going wrong, frustration, dissatisfaction. And I'll say a bit more about how this works in a minute, because it's a very interesting process, very educational process. that helps us, I think. Now, going back to needing nothing, like the Chinese sage, and I remember when I first came across this concept, when I encountered Buddhism, it sounded pretty dead. It sounded rather dismal. You know, why would you bother getting up in the morning if there wasn't something you were trying to get out of the day, something you were trying to get up for? On the other hand, I sort of thought this through, and on the other hand, imagine that you were so perfectly satisfied, so perfectly contented, that whatever is happening is fine. And I think that's the key to what's going on in Buddhism, that sense of, which maybe is a bit difficult to relate to, because we're probably not very often in that state, but where you just wake up in the morning and you get up and everything is absolutely fine. And you have your breakfast, and you enjoy it, you go and see people, you enjoy it, all that kind of thing. Imagine if every day was like that. And in a way, that's one way of looking at the goal of Buddhism. And significantly, from a Buddhist point of view, if you manage to get to this kind of a state, it's even fine when unwelcome things are going on, when unpleasant things are going on, in the sense that you're prepared to turn towards them, you really face them and not run away from them. And that's also a key to this. It's all very well saying everything's fine when everything is really hunky-dory and things are going well for you, but they won't always go well. Sometimes things will go wrong. What do you do then? And that's when the craving tends to kick in. You'll try to compensate for it. So could you imagine being in such a contented state? So why is it that craving makes things worse, if indeed it does? According to Buddhism, happiness doesn't come from getting what you want. And I think this is, I don't know, this is rather counterintuitive, because obviously we spend a lot of energy in our lives trying to work out what it is we want from life and then trying to get it. And we assume that that's the way you get happy, by getting what you want. But according to Buddhism, that's not the way to do it. In fact, happiness comes from not having a needy approach in the first place. So it seems to go against basic human drives, and I'll try and go into that in a minute, so don't bear with me on this. The idea is that craving for the things that you want leads inevitably to grasping and clinging, and those in turn are the basic causes of our human frustration, our suffering. But not only does craving actually lead to unpleasant experiences, the strange thing is that the craving itself is unpleasant. It's a nagging sort of feeling when you have craving. And in a way, that's why you want to assuage it as quickly as possible by getting the thing that you're craving. That seems the natural solution to that. There's a quote, there's a book here. I'm going to recommend two books, actually. If you want some simple introduction to the basic concepts of Buddhism, Introducing Buddhism by Chris Pauling, I would recommend, which is downstairs in the bookshop and very cheap. If you like a more sophisticated approach to, in a way, Buddhist psychology and how the mind works, how craving works, I would recommend this one called Mind in Harmony by Subhuti. It's quite technical, so don't go for it if it's your first ever Buddhist book. But I've got a quote from it here. Craving is painful. Craving is the longing for pleasure that we're not yet enjoying. It's a state of privation or lack, and hence of uncomfortable tension. As long as we have some hope of satisfying the craving, we usually fail to notice its unpleasant side, because the anticipation of future pleasure conceals the present pain, as sugar can conceal a sharp taste. And there's even an Indian teacher who suggests that what we think of as happiness or pleasure, is not in itself happiness or pleasure. So you see, you buy a Magnum ice cream or something like that, and you start to lick it, and you feel pleasure. But what's actually going on there? And what he's suggesting is that it's only the immense relief of being temporarily free from craving that feels like pleasure. And perhaps some things, including sugary treats, in a way are not really pleasant in themselves. I don't know if you've ever given, like, tried just giving up chocolate for a month or something. I recommend it. It's a very interesting thing to do. You'll notice whether you've got an addiction initially, because you'll have a struggle. And then after a while, you get less interested in it. And you try some again. And you try to remember, why was I so keen on this before? And then, of course, the sugar after a while kicks in and you're addicted once again. A bit like giving up smoking. You know, you sort of maybe you give up smoking a few years later, you try a cigarette. Why was I doing this every day? I can't quite remember. And it could be that that Indian sage is right, and that in a sense it's the assuaging of craving, which is a large part of a lot of our, of that need-based pleasure. Not pleasure in general, but that need-based pleasure. Like just going for another hit of a strong addictive drug. Okay, let's stand back a bit, get existential, and have a look at what life is like and how craving fits into life. So, what's it like to live a human life? And in a way, what we're doing is we're spending our lives, you might say, bumping into stuff and then responding as best we can after we've bumped into stuff. That's, in a way, in a simple way, that's what's going on, isn't it, moment by moment in our life. It's like walking down the Holloway Road out here. You're passing different shops and cafes. You're passing people and cars. Sometimes you go in and buy something or have a coffee. You're thinking about things. You end up at Highbury and Islington tube station. And it's all just one thing after another, one experience after another. Life is a flow of experiences. At least this is the primary way that Buddhism looks at it, rather than trying to get into the philosophy and say what is real and what isn't real. We are having a flow of experiences, and we're responding to those experiences, which in turn is affecting our future experiences. So it's really worth taking this great stream of experiences seriously and trying to learn from them, isn't it? Because we will learn. If we look at it mindfully, we'll learn how our experiences fit together. Some of them are pleasant, some of them are unpleasant, and some of them are just of no interest. Maybe the majority of no interest, actually, if you look at it. And we're very selective. We home in on those things that look as if they might give us a reward, or look as if they might be something to get away from as quickly as possible. You know. If we encounter something pleasant, the natural tendency, obviously, is to approach it, is to get closer to it. It's attractive. We want more of it. And we pull it towards ourselves, or we move towards it. And that's a basic and very reasonable instinct, isn't it? If it's unpleasant, the opposite happens. Aversion, which means avoiding it or trying to get rid of it or to push it away. If it's of no interest, then we ignore it. And those three responses are the themes of the three talks I'm going to give. So I do think it's a really basic thing to understand human life, isn't it? To realise that we've got this great stream of experiences. So a lot of experiences are of no interest, no relevance to them. We may not even notice them at all because of that. But other ones we home in on, they are of interest, and it's because either they're promising some kind of a reward or they're promising some kind of a unpleasant experience or a danger or something like that. And therefore we respond to some of those experiences by moving towards and some by moving away. Maybe it's obvious, it's very simple, but it's a really interesting little key to understanding what life is like, I think. It's certainly the way the Buddha looked at things. Moving towards, pushing away, ignoring. These are compulsion or craving, aversion or hatred, and confusion or delusion. So they're pulling us and pushing us, these different experiences, partly because of our preferences. And we differ from each other on those, don't we? There are not everybody goes for Magnum ice creams. We have our own personal likes and dislikes. And the question is, who is the boss? A lot of what we like and dislike is fairly arbitrary, yet we tend to allow it to govern our lives. We tend to allow those pulls and pushes, those preferences, to govern our lives, which is really understandable because it's such a primordial, primeval response that goes way back in evolutionary time. Especially, we're pissed off when we don't get what we want, and we object if we get what we don't want. But if you think about it, is it going to be possible to arrange your life so that you always get what you want, and you never get what you don't get. I suspect not. I mean, the immensely rich and influential, if you think about what you know about them, they presumably have got rich and influential partly so that they can arrange their lives, so that they nearly always get what they want and they hardly ever got what they don't want. But is that what they actually experience? Is that what Mark Zuckerberg actually experiences from moment to moment? Does he have a life which is entirely filled with pleasure and what he wants? I don't know, actually, I don't know. Maybe somebody here might know an immensely wealthy person and see whether they succeed. But, you know, we do put a lot of energy into this and trying to arrange our lives so that we get what we want and don't get what we don't want. So it's really fantastic if you can get a sense of the problematic nature of craving and aversion. Why is it problematic in the case of craving? I mentioned it leads to suffering. Why does it lead to suffering? It's because the basic cause, according to Buddhism, is because the thing you crave is impermanent. Nothing is reliable, in other words. If you could find something, I suppose a good example of this is a human being. So we look for a partner in life, which is a lovely thing to do, but we find that they are not exactly what we thought they were. And even if they are, after a year or two, they're different. And we need to allow them to be different. It's really unfair to insist that a partner is always going to be just so for us, because that's what we thought they were, you know. Yet we get sort of almost upset, don't we, if they, but you're not the person I married, it's not fair, you know. And similarly, for the other things that we like, we really enjoy as a child, of course. We love going to the fairground and zooming round and round and stuff. Then we go again as an adult and think, why did I like this? I don't know. So if you latch on to things in this way of craving and grasping, they will disappoint you. So this at least is, there are other forms of suffering that arise from craving, but this is one basic form that nothing is reliable. So it's better not to arrange your life around just getting what you want, because you won't actually find it leads to happiness. We're hankering also after new experiences. It's as if we can be desperate for stimulation in the hope that some of these stimulations will actually be ultimately rewarding. So this sort of sense of compulsion, of obsession, maybe I'm exaggerating, but I'm sure at least sometimes you probably experience something of that nature. And maybe you probably already noticed how it doesn't always work. But even worse, if we govern our lives by likes and dislikes, by the search for gratification, then when will we have time to find meaning and significance in life? It seems to me really important that you find something that actually matters to you, that you want to put your energy in, not simply because it's gratifying, but because you can see it has its own real value. It makes a difference to the world. That's quite important. Pleasant experiences are wonderful, they refresh your life, but they can easily be contaminated by craving. And in that case, it's as if delicious food is turning to ashes in your mouth. And it's very, very disappointing. So one of the most radical, maybe counterintuitive Buddhist suggestions is no longer to let your preferences be the boss, to shift the seat of government in your life from your preferences. But how do you do that? I mean, you could invert it, couldn't you? You could always go for what you don't like and always avoid what you do like. I do not suggest that you run your life like that. That's not the point. The point isn't that we've got it upside down. It's that we're looking in the wrong place. So we need to find somewhere else to look. You use a different metric, a different scale of judging things. And what you do is you start to learn what is skillful and what is unskillful. These are the technical Buddhist terms. You don't try to go for experiences. Instead, you try to decide how to act. So you're much less passive to life. You're not saying, I'm going to face the direction where I'll get as much niceness as possible. Instead, you actually engage with life. You act. And you look at your actions, the volitional actions you do, and you say, I want to make them skillful. I want to make them less unskillful. And a skillful action is one which leads you into a more expansive and a more free state of mind, and which causes benefit to both yourself and others. And you can imagine this is a long, slow process to learn what does work and what doesn't work. It's not something that you can just know straight away. An unskillful action is one that yields experiences which are contracted, which are self-protective, which are anxious and tense, and which cause harm both to yourself and to others. So using this method, when you, for example, communicate with someone, you would try to be skillful in your speech. You would say, is this, to yourself, is this authentic? Is it coming from the real me? But also you would say, is it kind? Is it going to make the other person's day just a little bit better? So imagine that this started, I mean, I'm sure, again, for a lot of you, this is already a motivation, isn't it? So we're trying to move our motivation more into that area of skillful and unskillful, and less bothering so much about likes and dislikes and preferences. If you go down this skillful road, strangely, you find that life is much more rewarding than if you govern everything by simply what you feel like getting for yourself at the time. It's pretty tough, though, to do it. It is a difficult task. Buddhism is very demanding in this respect, I think. Imagine governing your choice of career, for example, by that. Rather than just, I want to go to something I just really enjoy, you'd say, I want to go to something that makes a really positive difference. Which includes a positive difference to your state of mind, by the way. It's not that you're just being a martyr. What if you tried to govern your love life by that? Your diet, your carbon footprint, your response to the next rough sleeper you meet, or your response to the most trying members of your own family. There are lots of challenges, aren't there, when you think of that. Imagine who is the most trying person in your family. Probably, maybe you're wise to avoid them, but it could be that you can start to communicate in a more skillful way. And that would be rewarding. But this isn't just about being pious or being a good person or a religious person. It's actually about feeling richer and more fulfilled. You get more joy from appreciation than you get from appropriation, if that makes sense. You get more joy from appreciation than you do from appropriation. You open yourself up to life. You dance creatively with life rather than stalking around like a hungry youth looking for a kebab after an evening of drinking, which at our worst, we're a little bit like that maybe sometimes. So let's have a closer look at that appropriating method so we can understand it and understand what we do if we do that. Craving and grasping. It's good to know your enemy. Well, craving is the impulse to get something that you haven't got. It's perfectly natural. And it can be healthy, this impulse, as I'll say later. Clinging or grasping is desperately hanging on to what you have got, but what you're afraid of losing. So there's a bit of a distinction there between craving on the one hand, clinging or grasping on the other hand. Clinging or grasping is a more advanced stage. So what kind of things do we crave? What kind of things do we cling to? And maybe the biggest one is, for most of us at least, is other people. What happens when you encounter, maybe what happens when you encounter a stranger, if you're honest about it. And I suspect that we've all got a tendency to see others, in a sense, as objects in relation to our own needs. Again, it's a natural thing to do. Not really seeing them as rich and mysterious and self-motivated human beings in their own right. But instead, you know, goodness, this person I met, they look so gorgeous. They smiled at us, they agreed to go on a date. But then, okay, you're on the date, the evening wears on, and gradually you realise that they are just another human being. They're caught up in their own concerns. They're not the vision of perfection that we longed for. It's a real person. So that's the thing, isn't it? Treat people as, this is obvious, I know, but treat people as real people, not as objects for our own gratification. So it might be a brief fling that we're having, it might be a lifelong partnership, but sometimes the function of that lover can be just to anaesthetise the pain of our own longing and insecurity. And that is not fair to lay that on another person, even though it's very tempting. So you can look out, if you like, for self-interest in your relationships. In particular, ask yourself, when they don't behave as you want them to, do you feel let down? Do you feel upset? Do you feel hurt? And in a way, just sort of reflect on that, just notice it, that it's happening. And then there's craving, that's for people. And then there's things. Our experience comes through the senses, and there can be a sort of a need to have something happening all the time. If you sit and there's nothing going on, just sit quietly with a cup of tea and there's nothing going on, you can feel quite uncomfortable, and you can reach for something to fill that void. At least a lot of us do that. Looking for gratification, looking for stimulation. And this even goes for the mind. You know, if you don't have anything going on in a sensory sense, if you're not in the middle of a James Bond movie or something, maybe the movie will start to play in your own mind and you'll be stimulating yourself with lots of planning, lots of worrying, and lots of ideas, memories, fantasies, and so on. So the problem in Buddhism is neediness, it's craving, this emotional thirstiness. And if you're bored or if there seems to be something lacking in your life, you long for intense experience. But it's not just when you're feeling empty that craving arises. It also arises, as we've seen, when you encounter a new thing which seems to be pleasant. And it's very hard simply to relish, simply to enjoy the beauty of something that you see or something that you taste. It naturally turns into a hunt for more of it. So imagine your favourite food. Your favourite food is just as enjoyable in small amounts as it is in large amounts. But we get into that slightly compulsive sense sometimes. We just keep on eating it. Just have a little bit of it. It's fine. Pleasant sensations, says Buddhism, often lead to craving, but they don't have to. And if they do, if you let them lead to craving, then the craving leads to frustration. And it leads to frustration because we might not get what we crave, what we long for, and having got it, we'll be afraid of losing it, which is the clinging, or perhaps it doesn't live up to our expectations. There are some other types of craving and grasping in Buddhism, which is grasping at ideas, grasping at your own identity, and a strange one, which is craving for oblivion. And all three of these I want to talk about in the third talk, because in a way they're to do with delusion and confusion more than they are to do with the emotion of craving. And these things all intertwine together. So grasping ideas, mental stimulation as an addiction. Craving for identity is your story about who you are and maybe the groups you belong to and what you identify as. And this can become a craving or a grasping. And then craving for oblivion, where unpleasant experiences just get too much for you and your craving is for everything to stop. And you can imagine this getting to extremes in suicidal thoughts and so on, you know. But from a Buddhist point of view, it's just another form of craving, and it does lead to suffering and frustration. So what happens if you do stay with the preferences metric in deciding what to do? What it tends to lead to is some form of addiction. And it's sometimes a little bit difficult to admit sometimes you have to admit you've got an addiction because it's a definite physical dependency on a substance. But if it's not like that, it can be difficult to admit it. But it may be the best description of when we get obsessed with particular needs. And particularly when going for them becomes a habit. Addiction is when craving becomes habitual. When you just want to watch yet another episode in season 3 of something or other on Netflix. Do you ever had that where it just seems to be a compulsion? Where in a sense, the part of you is saying, I'm just too tired. I can't manage another episode. Or I'm losing, it's not very good this, is it? I'm losing interest in it. But have you ever had the thing where you go for another one. Why do you do that? And it's because it's become addictive. It's become habitual, hasn't it? It's not easy to deal with this kind of thing, it seems to me. I don't find it easy. It's all very well having a stern voice at the back of your mind saying, don't do it, you mustn't do it. But actually, there's also a part of you that says, I want to, you know, and then maybe you regret it. So somehow it means bringing those two voices together. so that you can speak in a way with one voice and make a mindful, spacious decision. Okay, I could watch it. Maybe I will, maybe I won't. You know, what's going to be best in terms of future suffering, future frustration, or even just what's the best use of my time? And for this, the Buddha uses the metaphors of stickiness. You get stuck to things, or bonds. It's as if you've been handcuffed to it, or even prison. It's as if you're actually being imprisoned. They're quite strong. He uses very strong images sometimes, and something, oh, I know he's exaggerating, but actually, if you're honest, sometimes it can be like that. You really do feel that you've trapped yourself. And I know it's 2,500 years ago that the Buddha said all this stuff, but I do think that people deep down haven't really changed all that much. The technology is different, but our minds are not so different. That's my impression. And it's well worth listening to his analysis and his suggestions. And next week I'll tell you the background story of how he first came up with this teaching on craving, hostility and confusion. But what he said then in that first teaching was, the world is burning. He said, the world is burning. All experience is on fire with craving, hostility and confusion. And craving creates, according to Buddhist tradition, the fuel for this burning, the burning of suffering. He explained how craving leads to grasping, and the Buddhist word for grasping, upadana, is the same as the word for the fuel that you put in your wood-burning stove. It's a really strong element of human life. We're driven by craving, and if we're not careful, we're burnt by it. We're consumed by it, or at least badly scorched by it. Now, the goal of Buddhism, the traditional word for that, as you probably heard, is nirvana. And it's also really interesting to look at the etymology of that word, the word nirvana. It means putting the fire out. It means quenching. That is an end to suffering. Extinguishing the fire is what nirvana means. So this is a very strong metaphor in early Buddhism, the metaphor of things being too hot to touch and of getting yourself scalded and burnt by things. But if you hear a warning of this kind, it is easy to take it personally, to feel offended by it or feel diminished by it. And I think this is particularly a problem in the post-Christian West. We think we're being told that we're bad or we're sinful or we're worthy of blame. So I think it's good just to realise that the attraction process is completely natural. It's normal. We can learn from it, we can move on, but it's a normal thing. And it has positive sides to it. So desire is okay. Intention is okay. It's craving that's the problem. But there are different kinds of desire. There's the desire for stimulation, for gratification, that I've been talking about, which tends to cause problems. But there's also wholesome desires. So what kind of desires are wholesome? I would say, you know, just normal hunger. You're hungry, you need something to eat. You're thirsty, you need something to drink. Needs for well-being, for sex, for acceptance and belonging. That's a real, genuine, deep need that we have. They come from our evolutionary past. They also come from our upbringing as well. And as our species evolved, we needed to look out for food, for shelter, for companionship, for protection, for affection, for sex. They are just part of our natural, normal needs. And there's also another kind of desire which I think is very wholesome, and that's what you might call the desire for the unknown. The desire for the unknown, for a creative life, for a life that also brings happiness to yourself and to others, involvement with others, a desire for truth, for authenticity. These are all very positive. These involve the imagination. They tend to have an opening and freeing effect rather than a closing down and tensing up effect. So I don't know if you get the difference between them. However, even these wholesome desires, all of them, can become unwholesome. The skillful desires can become unskillful. And it's a learning process to make the distinctions. In a way, it's a very exciting process. It takes ages. But gradually you work out how it is that you're generating your own disappointments, your own frustrations, and how you can generate a rich life instead, where you're surfing the waves, exhilarating and delightful, not constantly being humbled over or tumbled over in the cold water. And this sort of, like, if you go on a cold day and you try swimming in the beach and there's really big waves, you get abraded as well, don't you, by all the shingle hitting you. And life can be like that at times. So you're surfing those waves instead of being badly mauled by them. So how do you work with craving? How do you work? How do you deal with it? And there's a sequence of things that you can do, a lot of suggestions from the Buddha. The first thing is just the process of noticing craving and staying with the experience. And this is the basis of mindfulness practice. As you probably know, mindfulness practice is a basic Buddhist practice, which is now becoming very popular. And one of the things that's important that you're doing that is you simply notice what's happening. Stay with it. So if you imagine being interested in what's happening, but without needing it to be just right, without needing it to be as if it was designed just for you, it may be uncomfortable, it may be nice, you just notice. And in particular, when you notice discomfort, you stay with it. You stay with that discomfort. And in Buddhism, renunciation is a great virtue. And what renunciation means is opening up a space where you don't automatically go down the path of preferences. Not acting on craving, not letting it turn to grasping, if you can. So you practice mindfulness of all your experiences, including the body, and you cultivate aesthetic appreciation as well. So as well as just being aware, you can actually cultivate particular ways of responding, the way of responding, for example, to beauty rather than to attractiveness. Very interesting distinction there, isn't it? An aesthetic response rather than this appreciating rather than appropriating. And one of the ways of doing this is to practice metta-bhavana meditation, the loving-kindness meditation which we teach here. And also practicing contentment, seeing if you can be happy and contented even when things are not all going right. And with people, delighting in how they are and their diversity rather than projecting our own needs onto them. So you learn, you notice how the craving can lead to suffering. Because of impermanence, because everything changes. If you hang on to anything, you'll tend to be hurt, you'll tend to be disappointed. So you just realise this deeply. And if you realise this deeply enough, it's what in Buddhism is called insight, vipassana, insight. And that means that there is now a touchstone. It's there with you all the time, you can remember. So if you try meditation, meditation is doing nothing. It's the calm delight of not needing anything, just sitting there. Sitting still, maybe watching your breath, maybe not meditating formally, maybe just sitting in your room and looking at the trees outside the window. Suffering is replaced by what's called wishlessness, this sense of contentment. Is a form of insight called wishlessness. And we will be doing meditation sessions in future Saturday mornings if you come at 10:15. Relish the moment. Remember this moment is timeless. Just drifting along in the flow of your experience. Not talking, not worrying. And even now, we can just do that for a moment. Just imagine what that's like. No talking, no worrying. Even though that's only half a minute of silence, you know, meditation's a longer period. Sometimes you get an amazing transition. You've been maybe engaged, maybe interested, maybe bored with the talk, lots of stuff going on in your mind, and then it sort of settles down and the mind clarifies and becomes contented, and it's really beautiful. So I'll finish very soon. craving and clinging are universal, very universal. And nearly all the time, probably, at the back of your mind, there's a sense, perhaps, of something lacking. And all of that insecurity that leads you to surround yourself with people that reassure you, or ideas that reassure you, or things that reassure you. And this is the way we tend to live our lives. Now, in a week or two, I'm moving, because I've become the chair here. I used to be over in West London, and I'm moving quite soon from a flat into a single room in a Buddhist community. And it is quite horrifying how many things I've accumulated over 10 years in a flat. Can you relate to that? Yesterday, I loaded up the bike with a huge box and two panniers full of books to take down to the Oxfam shop. The third lot I've taken down there. But I did actually feel, it was a bit difficult, but I did feel a sense of relief as well. And why are we hung about with so many possessions? It's a bit like being a Christmas tree that people keep hanging more and more things on, except we're our own Christmas tree. We've been hanging the ornaments on ourselves over the years. Or a bit like, you know, if you go on a Ryanair flight, you sometimes see people that have bought a special kind of coat, which is full of enormous pockets, so they can get more hand luggage onto the flight. It's like your life, you know, we're sort of wearing these coats, you know, with all sorts of stuff in them. So many possessions. So it can be quite a relief to take off that coat. And I haven't got there yet, but I can sort of extrapolate to a sense of what it might be like to need nothing, like that Chinese sage fishing with no bait and no hook. Imagine that, needing nothing. So you're free to act in the world in ways which make a real difference. So next week I'm going to look at how we respond to unpleasant experiences. I'll also give you more of the background. I'll tell you the story of the fire worshippers and the Buddha's teaching of the world is burning that he gave to the fire worshippers, where he introduced for the first time his warning about greed, hatred and delusion. And it said at the end of this teaching, the listeners were liberated from contamination through non-clinging. In other words, they got to that point through their contact with the Buddha, in that case, of needing nothing.